Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is the founder of ProductionExpert.com and Managing Director of Sociatech, Russ Hughes. But first of all, you might have heard a lot about catalog sales from celebrity musicians and wondered what it was all about. The companies that were investing have names like Concord Music, Primary Wave, Roundhill, Elridge Industries, and most notably, Hypnosis, and they've spent billions on acquiring song catalogs over the last couple years. So just to give you an idea of the celebrity musicians that have sold their catalogs, there's almost 200 of them that have done this, starting with Bob Dylan, Neil Young, Stevie Nicks, Imagine Dragons, Whitney Houston, David Crosby, The Killers, Barry Manilow, Dave Stewart, Blondie, Chrissy Hynde, Devo, Shakira, The Beach Boys, Linda Ronstadt, Paul Simon, Red Hot Chili Peppers, and it goes on and on and on. So why would these companies buy these song catalogs? Well, until last year, money was pretty cheap, and it needed a place to go. So the companies viewed song catalogs as an appreciating asset that was always going to throw off money. And the whole thought was, well, the publishers that have these catalogs now just don't know how to exploit them. The thing about it is, though, it's not easy to exploit a song. You can't get on the phone to a music supervisor and say, hey, use my Beach Boys song. Hey, use this Rod Stewart song. Because it doesn't work that way. What happens is a music supervisor picks what he or she thinks is the correct song for that particular film or television show or commercial, and that's what they use. So it's really difficult to exploit these catalogs. That being said, why would an artist sell? Probably the biggest reason is that they're getting more money than they ever would any other time, and such a huge infusion of cash up front is going to take away the financial pressure for the rest of their lives. Besides that, they also get a huge tax advantage, and it's also easier on their families after they pass. But is selling your song catalog always a wise decision? Paul McCartney actually learned this the hard way. When the Beatles lost control of their publishing company, Northern Songs, in 1969, he and John Lennon were shut out of the profits of dozens and dozens of Beatles songs. Since he learned how the music publishing business works the hard way, McCartney started buying up song catalogs, and that eventually led him to become rock's first billionaire. Then he told his friend Michael Jackson all about the value of the song catalog and how not to get burned like he had been. So in 1985, Michael Jackson outbid Paul McCartney for the rights of the 4,000-song ATV music catalog. And that included everything from Northern Songs, which included all those Beatles songs. Needless to say, Sir Paul was not amused, and he fought to get those songs back, which he did, finally, in 2017. You'll notice Paul McCartney is not on that list. So how does this apply to you? If you're like most of us, you probably don't have hit songs to worry about or worry about selling. But that said, songs are like children. You love them and you don't want anything to happen to them. If you sell them, then they're out of your control. The big problem happens when the company that buys them might have the best intention and you might totally trust them. But what happens if someone new takes over? Those songs are no longer your kids anymore. And if you're like most artists, you're going to have second thoughts about leaving behind the things that you worked so hard on during your life. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Also, I'm pleased to announce that my new Musicians AI Handbook is now available. It's packed with information about how AI can help you with new song, lyric, mixing, and mastering ideas, as well as music marketing to help you get your music out to the audience that you deserve. To get your copy, go to bobbyosinski.com/AI Handbook. That's bobbyosinski.com/AI Handbook. You can also find it on Amazon and Apple Books. Now, a company called Technology Without Borders did a lot of research and found out that noise-canceling headphones can actually trigger panic attacks. So this doesn't happen to everyone, only to people that already have anxiety problems, anxiety issues, and are prone to attacks like this. But there are good reasons why it's happening. For instance, heightened self-perception. And if you have panic attacks, this is not something that you really want to have happen. Same with an amplified internal dialogue and the sense of isolation. All these things happen when you use noise-canceling headphones, and it's not really good for you if you're predisposed to these conditions. Interestingly enough, this is very much like what happens when you go into an anechoic chamber. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been in one, but it's a very disconcerting process. The first thing that happens is you begin to hear your heart, and it's beating, but it's louder than you've ever heard it before. And then after a minute or two, you begin to lose your balance because there's no echoes in the room, so you don't have location info. Then you begin to hear the blood actually pumping through your veins and your bones grinding as you move. So most people can't stand more than a few minutes in an anechoic chamber. And for the longest time, the longest period that anyone stood in one was 67 minutes until a YouTuber named Calix on a YouTube bet stayed in one for an hour and 27 minutes, and it's something he said he'd never do again. So back to noise-canceling headphones. Not everyone is going to get an attack. If you don't have a history of anxiety-related issues, then it's most likely not a problem. However, if you do suffer from anxiety, you might want to experiment with using ambient soundscapes or white noise tracks while you're wearing these headphones. You might want to try just using regular headphones or earbuds instead of something that's noise-canceling. And also, it's always good to practice mindfulness and distraction techniques so you can counter those intrusive thoughts. When you're on a plane, there's nothing like having a pair of noise-canceling headphones to block out the distractions. But be careful if you have panic attacks, because the silence may be hurting you rather than helping you. My guest this week is Russ Hughes, who's the founder of Production Expert, a group of blogs for music and post-production professionals. Over the last decade, Production Expert, Pro Tools Expert, Studio One Expert, and Logic Pro Expert have become some of the leading industry websites with over 7 million visitors annually. Starting his career in the leading edge of music technology as a synthesizer program in the 80s, Russ soon gravitated to Soho, where he worked in commercial post, something that he still does. Eventually, he became an expert in Pro Tools, which led him to create his popular blogs. Top of that, Russ is also the managing director of Sociotech, a global marketing agency for the audio technology sector, working with some of its biggest brands. During our interview, we spoke about the unusual way the Pro Tools expert started, the pros and cons of using AI, moving from London to Ireland, the two character traits you need for staying in business, the gear-changing moments in his life, and so much more. I spoke at Russ via Zoom from a studio in Ireland. Tell me about you getting into the music business.
How to get into the music business? Let's rewind a little more. When I was a kid, my dad had a piano in his room. And he'd play like Oscar Peterson. Some of your listeners probably don't even know who Oscar Peterson is. My dad was a huge Oscar Peterson fan. And he'd play this stuff and I'd hear it. It was like magic coming out of his office. And sometimes I'd go in afterwards. I wouldn't go in there when he was doing it. It was kind of his own time. It was kind of, he didn't do it to perform. Although he'd been in a band. I remember he telling me once, he used to be in like this kind of club band in the 1950s and 60s. And they played 70 songs a night. And it was like, it's like most bands can't pull off 10 songs.
Yeah, right.
And he used to play a Hoff the President guitar. So he had this background, but that was before I was born. But then when I was a kid, I was about 6 or 7, I think, he'd be playing these Oscar Peterson tunes. And then when he'd finished, he'd leave the room and I'd go in and try and be dad and try and figure it out. So I'm a self-taught pianist in that way. So I was always into keyboards and stuff. In the early 80s, I ended up working in a music store, which was a big music store in the UK at the time, called Jones and Cross. It was in Birmingham, which is the second largest city in the UK. So we were quite popular. There was the Birmingham Odeon up the road and other venues. And so all the top bands would come into town. At this point, I'd started working in the keyboard and technology side of the business. And so I was the guy that knew how to use it all. And before I knew what was happening, I was being asked to program synths or show people how the MIDI worked on stuff by pretty big bands quite quickly. sometimes they come out of the studio and they would have recorded, you probably remember this, they would have recorded with the producer and he'd used all these synths. And then they'd say, they'd come to me and say, we're going on the road now. We don't know how he got these sounds.
Right.
And I'd be handed the album and have to figure out how the producer had got all these sounds on different synths. Or, for example, there's a band called T'Pau. I don't think they made it to America. They had a big song called China in Your Hand, which was a big hit. And I remember being called into the studio with them because they wanted to trigger backing vocals from some Simmons drum pads off an Akai sampler. And I had to help them figure out how to do it and stuff like that. So I got it. So I was at the early days of what we call programming. So I was programming MIDI, programming samplers, programming synths. I was one of the only guys at the time outside of Yamaha that knew how to do FM synthesis. So I did a lot of DX programming. So I was one of these. I was one of these people that we used to have in the industry called programmers. Do you remember us?
Yeah.
And I'd program synths and I'd program sequences and all that kind of stuff. And the truth is, Bobby, the only reason I got the job was because I read the manuals.
Yeah. Nobody does still today.
Still today, I've built a blog on over a decade of, because people don't read the manuals or learn how to use things properly. So yeah, it's no different. But yeah, that was kind of it. But also, I think I've always had a good ear to be able to hear a sound and know how it was made up. In fact, the one album that is one of my iconic albums of all time is Sean Colvin's A Few Small Repairs. Do you remember that album?
Yeah,
John
Leventhal. Yeah,
produce it, because I can't deconstruct that album. And for me, that's really impressive. If I can't figure out how they did it, I kind of think, yeah, that's some good producing there. There's loads of guitar parts on one of the tracks. I think it's called Sonica Home. And it's like, it's got baritone guitars. And I'm thinking, how the hell did he do that? And I've sat down with people and we try to figure it out. So that's how I got into it. And then I started writing and getting some publishing stuff. Still got publishing now. In fact, I don't know about you, but I've always said to people, if you want to make a living in music, get publishing, because it's like a pension.
Yeah.
2 checks a year. Still get them now. And I'm getting checks for songs I wrote 30, 40 years ago. And they weren't massive hits either. It wasn't like I'd written, like, I don't know, a huge hit. It was just I was working in a particular space, which was the gospel music sector. And even there, I've made money out of publishing. So get into publishing. First bit of advice from me today on your podcast.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, good. Okay, so you're doing that. And then you got into doing post, right?
Yeah. So it's a lot of people in the UK. Maybe it's the same in America. It might not have been the same. But a lot of people realized that you couldn't make that much money out of music anymore. So a lot of us ended up in post. So I ended up in... First place I was in was a place called Locomotion, which is just off a place called Soho Square. For people who don't know the British film and TV scene, you often think of Pinewood. A lot of people know that's where Bond is made. That's where Star Wars is made. That's out in the countryside, about 30 miles outside London. They have a second studio, Elstree, and those are the two big ones. But in the middle of London, smack in the centre of the West End, is a place called Soho. Not the Soho in America, the Soho in London. In that place, there's four streets. And when I was there, there were 200 post houses in four streets. And some of those post houses were doing things like the Harry Potter movies. And really big movies were being made in like sometimes tiny little rooms of three-story buildings. And that's always been the case. So I was in Soho in a place called Locomotion. And we were mainly doing, we did some broadcast work, but mainly doing commercial post work. So we were making like hairspray commercials and stuff like that. But in those days, the agencies were paying 100 grand a commercial. And so I was working, managing a post house. It was a full service post house. It had everything, sound and picture and everything and visual effects. And then I went to another one called Berwick Post. And so I spent about 4 or 5 years in Soho in London, which is basically the beating heart of the post-production industry in London. It's like the Hollywood of London almost.
You know, speaking of which, I'm in Burbank. And Burbank is the same thing. It's the equivalent of Soho. I can walk to Disney, to Warner Brothers, to ABC, NBC, the big TV networks, And then I don't know if there'd be 200, but there's 100 post houses around me, and I can walk to, again, at least a dozen I can think of, and there's probably some that I don't know about that are here. So it's the same thing. And just because you have the big studios in Burbank, you have, you know, the support industry around it as well. So all the audio dealers, you know, so it's one of those things.
So yeah, so I spent about 5 years in post. And in the middle of that, I was in the DUC one day, the Avid Forum for Pro Tools users. And it was about the time they'd acquired Wizoo, which became Air Virtual Instruments. And people were writing, hey, nobody knows how to use this stuff. Avid's not helping anyone. Somebody should do something about it. And I was taught years ago that when somebody says somebody should do something, what they actually mean is anybody but me. And so I, at the time, had at that point, so we're talking about 2008, and I'd been doing this stuff since the 80s. I'd been around so many cool engineers, so many cool producers, and I'd sat in rooms with them, but you watch how they mic a kit, or you watch watch how they replace snare drum, or you watch an EQ trick or something like that. And I thought to myself, well, I'll try and help. It was one of those moments where nobody could fire me because nobody had hired me. It was like nobody else is sticking their hand up for this. There's an old joke that goes around Bible circles which says, why did Moses get the job? And the answer was because nobody else would do it. Yeah. And it was a bit like that with the blog. It was like these people needed help. And I remember what I did. I think I made a video about how to use Expand, because if you remember, Avid were giving away Expand at that point. First, it came, most people don't remember that Expand first came on a DVD that you picked up at trade shows and you installed it when you got back to your studio. And I think I just made a kind of very basic video. And at the same time, I started releasing I had a massive sound library from all my history of doing this. So I started just putting some of my samples out there so that it'd work in Structure, because Structure had no real library available for it. And I thought, you know what, I thought half a dozen people watched this YouTube video and a few people download my samples. And I remember my wife saying to me, she said to me, they don't want your samples, Russ. They want your videos. That was a smart move. This was way before videos were what they were, what they are now. Nobody was doing what we were doing then, really, doing like tutorials on YouTube. And it just took off. I remember the first time we got 1,000 visitors to the site, I thought I had landed in like mega stardom. Well, not even stardom, just I thought this was, to reach 1,000 visits was really amazing. Little did I know how big it would get. But it was just me, Bobby, thinking some people need some help. Half a dozen people might take notice of this, and suddenly it all just exploded.
Was that Pro Tools Expert then? Was that was the beginning, but
it was the Air Users blog when I first started, because all it concentrated on was Air Virtual Instruments. And that went on for 2 or 3 years. And I would do that. I'd do a full-time job at the post house and come home at night. The reason I had the time to do it was a little bit of a rewind here. My wife had said to me just before I started the blog, my wife's very smart, Bobby. She was doing a post-grad thing in politics at one of the London universities, and she was doing it in her spare time. And she said, Russ, I'm going to be doing this for a year. You better find something to do with your time, because you're not going to see me. So it was one of those moments. And yes, I was doing 40 hours at the post house and then coming home and working till 2 or 3 in the morning on the blog and every weekend. And I just did it as an altruistic thing. I didn't do it to make money, didn't think it would ever be an income generating thing. It was just to help a few people out. And the rest, as they say, is history. That was then that I met Mike Thornton, who was doing a kind of similar thing with post and Pro Tools. And Mike said, why don't we put our heads together and support both the music and the post community? And we did that, and we became Pro Tools Expert.
And then Production Expert came a little while after. That was just an expansion on the idea?
Kind of. It was a pivot more than an expansion. It was recognizing that there were people who loved what we did but wouldn't always be Pro Tools users. They'd be using Logic or Cubase or Studio One. And we experimented on the way. We did like a Studio One Expert site. And we did a Reason Expert. We did a Synth Expert at one point. I always been of the view, Bobby, I don't know about you, but I'm not one of these people who kind of plan things out a lot. I kind of think, let's give it a go and see what happens. And sometimes my success is built on a lot of failure. They might not work. Second bit of advice to anybody watching or listening to this today is try stuff out. What's the worst thing you can do? You're not a surgeon or a pilot. You're not going to kill anyone.
Well, you don't learn unless you fail, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully I can pass on stuff. I can pass on my success because, and somebody won't have to fail because of it, because it was my failure first.
Now your role is somewhat different because you're taking a more global view of it all, a global view of the industry that you're providing. And I look back sometimes, a comparison. I find it very compelling.
Thank you. I think because I've got a different role, because on a day-to-day editorial basis, I don't have that much of a role. So they kind of give me the kind of, you know, the emeritus professor thing in universities. It's like, we can't find anything for Russ to do anymore, so we'll let him write a bit. We'll let him write. They call them, you know, they're called Russ Rants in house.
No.
Yeah, they call them Russ Rants. And I think what I'm trying to do is get a sense of the temperature of situations and then try to speak into them with a view on those things. I don't believe that I have the only word or the last word in anything I write about, but a one-to-one to view is try and bring to the surface sometimes things that I feel a lot of us are probably thinking but not saying through conversation. And sometimes people are saying it. A lot of my blog posts are born out of conversations, like you and I might shoot the breeze and stuff. And I think, oh, that was interesting what Bobby said. Let's explore that in a blog post. So I kind of using blog posts to try and generate conversations. One in particular recently, did you see me write the one about we need to talk about AI?
Yes.
Which is where I was trying to invite people to talk about the human part of this discussion, ironically, when we talk about computers doing things. And I'm always hoping that when I write for the blog and for the community, it's giving people permission to have that conversation then. Because we're often, especially in the modern world of production, a lot of us are siloed. I don't know about you. I don't work with a lot of people on a day-to-day basis. So I'm working from home. All my team work from home. A lot of the producers and engineers and other people in the industry I know are on their own a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So we're not getting those water cooler moments anymore. We're not getting those lunchtime moments where you and I would probably go and have a coffee and you'd say, how's it going, Russ? And I'd say, hey, but how do you feel about AI and that? And I find generally forums and social media is just too febrile a place to try and have a reasonable discussion before it descends quite quickly into you're a Nazi, which is apparently about 6 points down in the thread.
Yeah.
Get my point. I think it's too febrile and too polarizing a place generally, social media, to try and have grown-up discussions and reasoned-out discussions. And so when writing, I'm trying to get a sense of how the production community is feeling and then giving them a sense of not feeling alone, if that makes sense. And I always love it when somebody says in a comment, you've written this as if you know what my life is like right now, because I feel then I've probably done quite a good job of condensing somebody's emotional feelings.
You know, it's funny because the engineers of my generation who grew up in the studios in the 80s and 90s, one of the things that everyone, I think, universally laments is the fact that the studio complex has died for the most part.
Yeah.
And that was one of the most fertile places. Again, you know, you'd be in the kitchen and you'd run into other people, or in a hallway or whatever. You'd run into people, artists, whatever. And just the cross-pollination of ideas, the thing of, oh, come on in and have a listen. It was always, you know, something that you learn, and you can't do that today because you don't have that same possibility. You don't have those facilities any longer.
I agree. I think that technology has done a lot to enable us, but it's also done a lot to disempower us on a human level. And much as I love and respect, I know half the people working in the sector that are trying to do things like collaboration software, there's some fantastic work being done in that sector. I think it's an answer, but I don't think it's the answer. There's a great story. I might have said this before when we've been talking. It's a lovely story. I'm using it in some of my posts sometimes. A guy is woken in the middle of the night and there's a raging thunderstorm going on outside. And he's got a 3-year-old daughter. And he runs into her bedroom to see if she's okay. And she stood there at the window looking at the lightning flashing and the thunder coming. And he goes up to her and he says, don't worry, honey, God's with you. And she says, but daddy, I want someone with skin on. And that's such a profound story.
Yeah.
Because what we seem to be lacking now in modern production a lot of the time is someone with skin on. Someone sat next to us in that room. I remember the amount of times I was in the studio and we'd all be sat behind the mixer as he's mixing, and he'd shut up most of the time so he could do his job. But just being in that room, and he might turn to you at some point and say, what do you think of that guitar? Or, yeah, is that vocal okay? Or should we go and do another take? A lot of that's gone. And I think we got to find ways to reestablish that human connection, because creativity is a human pursuit completely, which there's lots of things. I'm watching AI very carefully. I don't think for 1 minute that can ever be replaced. That human pursuit that comes out of the human condition, doesn't it? Some of the best songs out there. I was writing about something yesterday. Imagine. You couldn't write the song Imagine without having been part of the human condition. You could copy it, which is what AI can do, but you couldn't have that. Imagine is an incredibly visceral song.
I've written a book about AI, have a online course on AI for music production, and I've studied it a lot. I've gone through about 200 different AIs, so I have a lot of hands-on experience. And I have to say, although there are some things that will jump out and you go, oh, that's great, for the most part, it's disappointing.
Yes.
And it's disappointing because what you expect as the norm, you never get, but it doesn't change things in a pleasant way. So just like if you go to a text-to-music generator, for instance, and there's some new ones that are coming out, what it gives you, you'll think, that's tremendous orchestration. The sounds are terrific, and the mix is really good, but it's kind of silly the way it's put together. No one would ever do that. That said, sometimes, you know, having an extra bar or something in a song is brilliant, but this is in such a way where it's like, it's so random. It's like, really?
Yeah. But I think I totally agree with you. And like you, because like with bloggers, there's generative AI for writing now, and we're exploring ChatGPT, and we have to, because it's an important part of, I think closing up the shutters and saying I'll have nothing to do with it is the wrong approach. But coming back to, where do I feel generative AI is right now? I feel it's production pornography. And what I mean by that is that Pornhub can't replace the intimacy I have with my wife. It can do a fake version of it. It can make me think that at that moment, I won't go into too much graphic detail, but you get the point I'm making.
Yeah.
The sequence of Pornhub isn't going to replace the human connection I have with the woman I love. And it's the same with AI. AI can do a great fake, which some people won't care about if it's a fake. Some people won't know the difference. But for those of us who want the authenticity of human connection, we still need that. And that's, I'm very passionate about the whole human condition in the creative sector, because I think that's where it's born from, and that's where it thrives, is when humans do this stuff. It's what separates us from animals.
Now, one of the things that I think is going to come from this is we're going to circle back around to real live music with mistakes, because there you go, that's the human condition, but it's so much more vibrant than what we're getting now, which is very homogenized. And you can even say that about a lot of the pop music that's out there, which is basically sample-based, loop-based, synth-based, with a vocal on it and maybe one live instrument or something. But I think we're going to get so much of that that there's going to be a new trend that'll come around to real players playing again. I'm hoping.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think AI, generative AI, is in the realm of flying cars and autonomous. Like, I don't ever give a shit about driving an autonomous vehicle, because driving is quite fun. Why would I want to sit in a metal box and just let it happen? But strange enough, I love trains. I think trains are one of the most wonderful forms of transport on the planet. I love going on trains. But to imagine that I don't have any interest in autonomous vehicles in that sense. And I've got quite a clever car already. I've got an EV that does all sorts of mad stuff. But again, I don't want to say, the worry is that when, I hope people aren't hearing this, Bobby, and thinking, oh, we're two old guys saying get off my lawn.
Yeah.
It's not about that.
No.
It's about, just as porn can't replace true intimacy, generative AI can't replace true human creativity.
You know, you mentioned about autonomous vehicles. So I have a Tesla. And the month of April, they've given away free self-driving to everybody. And normally it would be a $9,000 upgrade or $10,000, $12,000, something like that. So I installed it and I tried it. And I was amazed. I asked it to take me to Home Depot. It made all the turns. It stopped at the right places. It did everything. It took me there. It stayed within the speed limit, the whole thing. When it got there, there's a self-parking feature. You just hit the button. It parks for you. It's wonderful. So I tried this a couple times just in amazement and quite enjoyed it. And then went back to driving myself because, as you said, it was more fun.
Exactly.
So there we go. I mean, that's a perfect example. Now, there are times when that's going to be perfect for you to do something like that. If you're in traffic, it's a lifesaver because you don't have to think about the traffic. But that being said, normally when you're driving, I think you live out in the country a little bit, so you don't have to worry about that so much. And where I live, I don't have a huge amount of traffic, so I like to drive.
Yeah, but when I'm in a queue, when it's boring and I'm sat in a queue and it's like, move car. I put mine in self-driving mode and I let it do it for me because that's a good time for it to happen because I don't want to be going accelerate, brake, accelerate, brake, accelerate, brake. I could sit there. I'm still keeping my eye on the road, but generally, coming back to the whole discussion, I think that I'm not anti-AI by any stretch. I use it every day of my life to do really cool things. I do it to draft email replies to clients and I get it to check my email replies to check the tone's okay. The one thing I found out about generative AI in the writing space is you've got to treat it like it's a 12-year-old assistant because in terms of age, because there's not one single piece of ChatGPT stuff I've ever had presented to me by it that I would put in the public domain and my name against it because it's just not good enough. It's wrong. It makes mistakes. It misquotes stuff. I once told it to write what was the best door on the planet just for a test. And it said that if you're using a PC, you should use Logic. And think, yeah, well, that's good luck with that.
Yeah.
So it's really good, but I'm not in the camp of robots are going to take over the world, and I'm not in the camp of dismissing it. I'm in the camp of healthy skepticism about it.
Okay, let's go here then. So one of the interesting things about AI that I find is the fact that when we talk about audio, there's some good examples of, for instance, track separation.
Accentize, we spoke about
Accentize, yeah, that's great. Yeah. Dialogue repair, things like that, where it's fantastic. But when it comes to other things, I have my doubts. Like, for instance, okay, let's do the auto EQ. Okay, great. I understand exactly what you're doing and you're comparing it against everything you think is supposed to be good. But does it work in the context of this particular track? So that could get you into trouble real fast if you think, oh, I'm just going to have it do everything for me. And then you step back and you go, oh, wait a second, that doesn't exactly sound the way I expected it to.
Well, have you noticed, actually, when I've been using AI, having used it enough now to see where it's good and where it isn't, the jobs it would replace right now are the kind of people who are trying to get into our industry, the assistant kind of jobs, the kind of base level jobs. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way. I'm meaning that when we got into it, and it still happens now to some degree, but when I got into it, I was cutting up cardboard boxes for about a year when I first got into doing stuff. And then I was generally allowed to do stuff. And a lot of the engineers you talk to, they weren't allowed on a board for about 5 years while they were making tea or tape hopping and stuff like that. And I can see how that kind of software you just mentioned could do you what the assistant engineer used to do and get you a rough mix up to start with. That makes a lot of sense. But what drives me crazy about AI is they're trying to do some things. I said a great joke the other day. Let's all calm down about 3D printers because we can't make regular ones work.
Yeah.
That was a great quote. But here's some great ways AI could work. Auto naming your tracks in your DAW. That would be a great way. So I think AI is brilliant for assistant type work. The boring, we talk, it's the same as the car again. Is that like, who wants to go through a piece of audio and clean it all up? So when AI can just clean it for you, that's a great, so you can get back to being creative and doing what's fun or setting the balance or auto gain or lots of things that are just boring old jobs so that we can, that's, let's not forget that when you watch Star Wars, that all the robots are assistants, they're not the boss. And as long as we work that, as long as we recognize that with AI, that as long as AI is an assistant, it's not the tail wagging the dog, then I think we embrace it fully. But even as an assistant, it can make a hell of a mess sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. We can go down the rabbit hole in this, but I want to make a left turn here for a second and talk about your book.
Go for it. Let's go somewhere else because I can get bored with that AI.
Yeah, let's talk about your book.
Oh, yeah.
So how did that come about?
My dad was a business guy, self-made. He'd come from nowhere. He'd grown up in a really tough family situation, in a really tough part of Birmingham, which is that place I talked about earlier on in the interview today. And he started his business by going around, picking up old bits of wood in a wheelbarrow and then selling them as firewood. That's a true story. It really is that kind of rags to riches thing. It came from nothing. And over the years, he built a really successful business in the insurance and finance sector. And my dad always had these one-liners that he would say about business. So one of them was, profit is what you don't spend. You don't forget that. It's like a hook from a song.
Yeah.
Another one he used to say to me, I remember it, because he wouldn't sort of say them like a comedian would go, bah-bah. I remember one day I used the accountant that he'd had when he was in business, and he was working for me, and he always helped me out. He was a great accountant, always made sure I didn't pay more tax than I should, always made sure I was kept out of trouble with all my finances. And he said to me, he called me one day and he said, Russ, he said, have you paid Graham yet? That's the name of the accountant. I said, Dad, I have. He said, good. Pay the good ones fast.
That's a good one.
And he would then he would unpack it. Anyway, so I went to Dad about 5 years ago. I said, Dad, I want to sit down with you and write a book based upon all these kind of one-liners for business, like profit is what you don't spend, pay the good ones fast, don't blame them, train them was another one. And I don't know if you've read the book, Bobby, but every chapter is one of those one-liners. Like hooks from songs that they got inside their earworms that once you heard them. So on my teams now, everybody knows these mantras. So when we come to doing budgets and stuff, they all know profit is what you don't spend. And so I said to Dad, let's do this. And my dad was one of these really sort of, he was a bit like a, he just said it like it was. He wouldn't only just piss on your fireworks, he'd absolutely put a fire hose on them. And I said, Dad, let's write this book. He said, no. He said, it's a silly idea. I said, why? He said, because I can't put my head on their shoulders. Another one-liner.
Yeah, right.
I said, what do you mean by that, Dad? He said, I can tell them all the advice in the world, but they have to actually do it. So that book idea died. During COVID, Dad got COVID and he died. He died in 6 days, start to finish. And whether it was a grief response from me or whatever, I just, after he died, thought, I'm going to write the book that he told me not to write. In fact, the book is called The Book Dad Told Me Not to Write. And it's chapters, very short chapters. You can read the book in a couple of hours. It's about 40,000 words. And I'm going to write this book to help those, especially in the media industry, to be able to run successful businesses. When I say success, I mean businesses that mean they can live. That's basically the definition of success in our industry most of the time, is that you can pay your mortgage.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And eat and get your kids through school. And so I wrote it. I wrote it in about 5 weeks, start to finish. And so it was published about 4 or 5 months after Dad had died. And it's proved to be really helpful for people. Done well on Amazon. You can get it off Amazon. And the reviews seem to be very positive. I didn't pay anybody to say those things. But I'm incredibly passionate again about this, Bobby, that, and I think you're very big on this as well from all the work that you do. So many people in our industry are accidental business people. They're a mixer and they got into it because they love mixing and suddenly they find themselves running a business. Or they end up running a studio or they end up owning a software company making plugins with 10 staff. And then nobody's ever told them about budgeting or invoicing or how to get business or how all those kind of things. So I've just put it all in this book. It's an easy read and I hope Dad likes it. The book Dad Told Me Not to Write is on Amazon.
Let's go another place here while I still have you. So let's talk about your home studio. What I want to know is you're way out of the mainstream where you live and it has not affected your business.
No.
When you left, were you expecting the business to come with you? Were you expecting there to be a problem?
I didn't know because I learned a long time ago. I saw it actually happen that you know, when you're in a company, let's say you're in a big studio complex and you think, I'm going to go out on my own. And about a month or two before you leave, you say to all the people coming to the studio, hey, I'm going on my own. And they go, well done, Bobby. I'll give you a call when you leave. Then when you leave, nobody calls you. It's not because they were being disingenuous. They've just been polite to you. But the truth is that most people, when it comes to business, it's better the devil you know, isn't it? It's like the inertia of change is harder than sticking with even something that might not be as suitable for you. So my business has changed somewhat because a lot of what I do these days is it's a much more holistic business that does video and music and all sorts of stuff because I've also got the agency Sociotech. So we make a lot of product videos and stuff like that. We have to make the music for that. We have to make stuff like that. And I do a little bit of writing, but in reality, I was saying to somebody the other day, I think I'm really going to get back into music when I retire because I'm so busy helping other people do it. I don't get enough time to do it myself. But in terms of business, I moved out into the middle of, I live in Northern Ireland on the coast now. My wife's Irish and we moved out here when we had our baby because that's the kind of thing Irish girls do. They go back to mommy and because she's just on the road. So I was doing the kind of like what we call now, what everybody started doing during COVID, I've been doing it for 10 years. So when COVID happened and everybody said, oh, I've now got a studio in the garden or a studio in the loft or a studio in the cellar, I've been doing that for a decade. So I never needed, I never do any attended work ever. It's all somebody says, here's a project, come up with a project, go do approvals back and forth. And that's how it's done. So the footfall was never an issue. People traveling to me was never an issue because I've got a mixed studio here, Bobby. I don't have a recording studio. I don't do any recording here. If I need to do recording, I'll go to a separate recording studio. So I don't need clients to be here. And so that's cool. A lot of people work like that, I know, these days. Because clients never visited me anyway, it's never affected me in that sense. I really thought I was committing suicide when I left Soho, if I'm really honest with you. Because like everybody says that unless you're in Soho, everything's going to die. And so I remember I left Soho for my health actually first and started working from home because I was drinking too heavily, I was eating too much, and I was a heart attack waiting to happen. And so for my own sanity and my own health, I left and went to work from home. And I didn't see any change in business, to be fair. There's a chapter in my book, Reputation is Tomorrow's Profit. If you work hard to build a reputation, your clients will follow you.
I knew this was going to work like way before COVID when I saw Bob Ludwig move out of New York City. Ludwig, the mastering engineer.
Yeah.
And moved to Portland, Maine, which was way, way, way out of the mainstream. And yet he had everybody follow him there. You know, Bruce Springsteen and all the major artists would still follow him there. So there was never a problem. And I thought to myself, okay, I think this is going to work. If he could do it, now obviously he's on a level that most other people are not, but nonetheless it shows that it can be done. And certainly we've seen that to be the case since then.
Can I give you a sneak? Actually, I'll give you a sneak preview of an article that's coming out on the blog soon, which is two things I think are essential for modern audio creatives to have as character traits for this very reason. The first one is excellence. I don't mean perfection. Perfection is rarely possible. But in a world where everybody's looking for hacks and shortcuts and quick fixes and generative AI and all that, excellence will set you apart. It will mean that you deliver, you exceed your clients' expectations when you deliver your projects. I had a lovely call with a client yesterday I've just been working with who said, you've taken us to a new level. And that was just a wonderful quote to get from them. And it was lovely. Now, I was really pleased because you too many people overpromise and underdeliver, and you need to flip that around and underpromise and overdeliver. Because so that you delight your customers. So excellence is the first character trait I think everybody should have. But here's the second one that's probably going to flip a few people's heads as I say it. The second character trait you should have is kindness. Because we're living in an unkind world now. Meanness is the spirit of the age, whether it's on social media or whatever. And if you can show kindness in your business dealings, in your dealings with musicians, your dealings with other creatives, if you can be the person that's got the kind word. I heard this said to me a few years ago. It's not me that said this, it's somebody else. People often forget the details of a situation with you, but they'll never forget the kindness that you extended to them. And I think that's true.
That's good.
I also think that kindness is contagious. If you show kindness to other people. So I think these are two things that I think that we should all hold firmly in our hands as creatives in this modern age of reducing budgets, reducing deadlines, threats from generative AI, people trying to do it on the cheap, everybody saying it's easy and diminishing the role of expertise, diminishing the role of experience, diminishing those of us because we're too old or diminishing people because they're too young. And I think in that situation, we've got to come along and say, okay, I'm both going to be excellent and show kindness in my dealings. And I think that's a pretty killer combination.
Yeah, it is. It's a great observation, Russ. One other thing about your studio. So because of your position with the blog and everything, you're exposed to more gear than most people are in our industry. Was there a piece of gear or piece of software that as soon as you got it, you went, wow, I have to have this no matter what?
Okay, I'll name a number of them.
Okay.
The gear-changing moments in my life. The first one I would say was when I got Key 3 speakers. The first time I heard a pair of Key 3s was the first time I heard a pair of speakers where I didn't hear the speakers. I was hearing the music. I was with James Ivey, who used to be on the blog, still a friend of mine, and we were in Germany at the launch event at Frankfurt Music Messe. We're in a glass room in a hotel 5-6 floors up, and they had a pair there, and they had a laptop playing the music, and we were supposed to be going out for dinner with the guys from Key, and me and James were arguing for about 2 hours about what song we were going to play next from our memory collection, because they had like a database of every song that was like Spotify, and so I'd play a Police track, and then he'd play Yes, the classic Yes track, Owner of a Lonely Heart.
Yeah.
And then we'd play Grace Jones, Slave to Rhythm. Then I'd play a bit of Frank Sinatra and then a bit of Mozart. And we were there I just fell in love with the listening experience again. And that was partly it. But then what was even more, then they sent me a pair to try in my studios. And what was the most profound thing was that I've never had stuff sent back for revisions in the several years I've had them, which is insane. Translation on them is insane. Now, as somebody working in the audio world, that's got to count for something big. If you've got a product that you can trust, that you love using, and it makes your clients happy, they're not going, oh, the vocal's a bit weird, or what's that going on? That it was things like, I remember I listened to Buggles' video, Killed the Radio Star, and for the first time in the history of it, I'd heard it for like 30 years, and suddenly I could hear an acoustic guitar in the chorus I'd never heard before. It was mad. That was one of them. E3s. And there's a Key 7 coming, which is a smaller, cheaper version, about half the price. When I say cheaper, the base Key 3s are 15 grand a pair. The 7s are going to be about 7 grand a pair. So that was it. The second one I'd say was the first time I tried the Avid Carbon. That was like me plugging into a 244 Forte studio in 1982, because the immediacy of the hybrid workflow. So the Avid Carbon, for those that don't know, it's got some HDX chips inside it. And what it does is it just flips them in when it needs them and flips them out when it doesn't. So you don't have to think about, oh, let's set the latency and all that kind of stuff. So I remember I got this massive track up and I thought, I'm going to replace the piano. So I got my piano and I plugged my piano in two of the stereo channels and I'm playing along, zero latency, as good as, not enough to know, no more than if you were playing live. And it was like, wow, it was just, and Julian had been telling me from the blog about a year and a half, oh, Russ, you've got to try Carbon. I'm going, no, latency is not a problem. We all get around it. But this is such a seamless workflow. So that was the second one. And then perhaps third one I'd say recently, especially with the video work I do, and we talked about it at the start of this call, is Accentize DX Revive. I work with the guys over at Accentize. And the first time they sent me the beat of it and said, oh, it's a noise reduction one. I thought, I've heard all of these. And then I turned the knob up and thought, this isn't possible. This is where AI is just a gift.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about really shitty radio audio recordings from like phone-in shows or Skype calls, or the test it sent me was that it got a piece of audio from the moon landing. And it went from moon landing like, and it's to suddenly being like, a really good recording. And I remember then I and it was another moment. It was a bit like the Key moment. I was going online and going through my drives, trying to find all the shit audio I could possibly find to see if it would work on DX Revive. I remember I downloaded, you might have seen me share it on Facebook. I downloaded Frank Sinatra's speech when he won an Oscar in about 1957. And it was in a big echoey room, big old mic. It's the recording of the day. And it takes it from that to him sounding like he's in a booth on a U50 on a full body condenser mic.
Yeah, yeah.
This is mad shit, and it's great. This is a transformative moment. So for me, Bobby, don't know about you. And another one in musical terms, I've got a Taylor acoustic guitar, and I've had it for 20 years, and that was probably the first thing I ever got when I thought, yeah, I'm glad I got this. I think in terms of musicality, I don't know about you, I want instruments that inspire me. I'd love to have a grand piano for that reason, because keyboards are great, but there's something about when you lift the lid on a grand piano and sit down, and 2 hours later, you're still tinkling around, and you've got all these kind of cool ideas coming up. And it's like, that's what instruments are meant to do. They're meant to not just be tools. They're meant to be something that you have this visceral moment with. So my Taylor Acoustic. Yeah. So there's lots of stuff. To be honest, people say to me some days, what's the best interface? I go, any of them. We come from an age, Bobby, when most of this stuff, stuff cost the price of a house or it was shit. Now stuff that $100 audio interface sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. We've come a long way with that.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people go on forums, they're arguing about converters or preamps and things. Just go and make some bloody music.
Yeah, please. Yeah, right. Cool. Last question, Russ. What's the best piece of advice that maybe somebody imparted to you or maybe you learned along the way?
I know what that is straight away. I was just about to go and I used to do some sort of public speaking, and I remember somebody sat with me, this old guy, really wise old guy, put his hand on my shoulder just before I walked out onto the stage to do some public speaking. And he said, the greatest freedom is knowing you've got nothing to prove. And lots of us get caught up in this trying to prove ourselves, whether it's in the studio, whether it's in a conversation. Do you know what? That really proved itself. Do you remember that you and me, Michael Carnes, and Cliff from Marg Audio went out for dinner one night? And that was a moment where you got an enormous amount of breadth of knowledge and talent. Cliff is a walking genius. Michael Carnes is a walking encyclopedia. And that was the night where I thought that actually the best thing I can do here is shut up and listen and just let, I probably did say some stuff, but you know, when I was younger, I'd be going, I've got to say something that's impressing these guys, or I've got to come out with some smart comment. And actually that's just trying to sort of prove ourselves. And I think it's probably to do with age as well, is the sooner we can learn to just be still and not have to try and prove ourselves all the time, I think the more useful we are as people, and I think we're better people to be around as well. So that's my advice, especially to the younger people who probably listen to this, Bobby, because the older you get, I don't care these days, most of the time, I hardly see people these days anyway. So I joke that the older I get, the less people I like.
That may be universal, though.
I think that's what makes us in this world, men. But then to the young people, quite joking apart, the greatest freedom is knowing you've got nothing to prove. You're a unique entity on this planet. Nobody else can do what you do, or more importantly, nobody else can be you. So just rest in that and let your uniqueness shine through.
You can find out more about Russ at russ-hughes.com. That's Russ, R-U-S-S, dash Hughes, H-U-G-H-E-S, russ-hughes.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There, you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.